Well, welcome everybody. We have Pat Brewer. Guy I met a couple of years ago, seduced him into baby bathwater, kind of against his better judgment, but he kind of came in. And he's kind of our wealth guy. He manages a lot of people's portfolios. He's grown a very large company. He's actually merging into a bigger company. He's done really well, and is actually advising a lot of baby bathwater people and a couple clients. And so he's probably the most sophisticated person we have in our group, just on general money things, personal money, business money, et cetera. So now that COVID's gone on for a while, we had him on at the beginning with some other people, and that was great. But now that it's, you know, where it is, people have a lot, you know, way more questions. And obviously Hollis and I can't answer any of this stuff. And then I didn't want to get some people spewing out stuff. But we wanted to hear from Patrick. He's pretty reasonable, doesn't do crazy stuff. So welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Michael. Super excited to chat with everyone who's on the call and anyone listening to the recording. So hopefully get to talk about some fun stuff.
For this recording. So the overview is really just what to do with your money, whether it's your company's money or your own money now, based on this kind of this crazy time. We all watch the news and everybody has his opinions. And one thing I like about Patrick is that when he doesn't know, he doesn't know. So a lot of these are odds, not fact, you know, they're facts, but they're not like, here's how it's going to be and just do this, this, and this. That's not how he is, which I appreciate.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's important to acknowledge. Like, none of us have a crystal ball. There's just too much complexity in global markets, trying to incorporate different things from, you know, how COVID could impact industries, specific businesses, global economies, how currency markets could react, all this different stuff like rolls into what the prices are today, what they could be in the future. And, you know, I think what we can talk through is just some general data as far as like what's happened in the past, what we're seeing in the data right now, and then hopefully tie that together in some recommendations, general recommendations around how you might want to think about it. The challenge with finance is everyone's situation is a little bit unique. Some people have a lot of a very high risk tolerance. Some people don't. I think in this group, we probably have a fairly good capacity and willingness to take risk. So I'll kind of structure the answers and kind of thoughts around that spectrum. And if anyone jumps in and has questions, I'm happy to make this conversational.
Yeah, I think we no longer do that. Now we just record it.
Oh, really? Oh, sweet. Okay, cool. Yeah. I'm just going to riff then. Sounds good.
Yeah, so we have, because I think the big variables that have changed that everybody's on their mind, there's obviously COVID, right? That's happening, and nobody knows it's going to happen. There's the elections, right? There's the judges. I mean, there's basically the Supreme Court thing going down. There's COVID going down, and a possible political switch.
Yep.
And then there's other stuff happening in the world, and there's a huge health crisis and all kinds of things going on. So I think a lot of it is like with all these craziness, and we don't know when a vaccine's happening. We don't know anything, right?
Yeah.
What are smart people doing?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the challenge that entrepreneurs have is we're used to generating high expected returns in our own business. So or high average returns in our own business. So we have up years, down years. We have some really solid outlier years where we do very well. But we tend to also project that onto what we should receive from capital markets or private investments that we make. So I think right now, one of the biggest things that I'm noticing is interest rates are really low, right? Which is good in one sense, because it stimulates spending. People can, you know, go out and get a mortgage for a lower rate. So they might buy a new house, they might buy a new car. But it also has impacts on what global markets are willing to return as far as, increases in price and just expectations around, you know, future returns. So I've got a chart where I'm going to walk you guys through kind of how that the lower interest rate environment could impact your decision around where you want to put your money. But I think where most people's head is at, if just from conversations that I've had with our clients and other people who have sought out our services, is they don't really know if now is a good time to invest at all because there's so much uncertainty, right? And in March, there was obviously a ridiculous amount of uncertainty with the onset of COVID and closing of businesses, interest rates at zero. It was just a very weird time. And still hasn't recovered from an economic standpoint, but the markets have been pretty disconnected from economic fundamentals. They've just gone right up, throughout that entire time.
Maybe sometime here, I want to cover that. It's so fucking weird to me. I don't get that at all.
It's really strange. I think some of it's being driven by the stimulus. Some of it's being driven by, my thought is that right now the markets are pricing in a re-election for Trump. So my guess is that market prices and the kind of the greater population is pricing into the markets the idea that Trump is going to win the election. There's actually like a pretty cool, I'm just going to share my screen here and just walk you through this. But if you look at the performance of the S&P, let me see if I can do this.
There we go.
See my screen? We good?
Yep.
Cool. So looking away from the polls and, you know, other political indicators and things, if you look at the S&P 500, which is just the 500 largest stocks in the U.S. market, it's actually been a really good indicator of who is going to win the presidential election. So performance of the S&P 3 months before votes are cast has predicted 87% of elections since 1928 and 100% since 1984. So what we're looking at here is if the performance for 3 months leading up to the election is positive, there is an 87% chance since 1928, and 100% chance since 1984 that the current president will win. So if you look at the data, 3 months out, we're up 6.76% in the S&P. So the market is pricing in, based on historical data, that Trump will win the election. And there's obviously a number of different ways you can skin this data. So this is just one way to look at it, but it's an interesting take on the financial markets. My thought is, and this is an opinion, so let's disconnect the opinion from the data. My thought is that Trump is going to win the election. And I think that securities prices are reflecting that right now. I think that if he was to lose the election, we're probably going to see an adjustment in securities prices, and that could be fairly significant. And again, that is an opinion. It's not rooted in any type of data other than, you know, me thinking that right now the markets are overpriced relative to this outcome.
Right. You and Nate Silver can have a debate about that.
Yeah. And then if we look at, this is just a cool chart that I found that looks at the performance of the markets during different cycles, different presidential terms. What you'll notice is that the market just goes up over time, financial markets. And most people think about the markets like, the stock markets are boring. I want to invest in venture capital and private equity. I mean, it's the same thing if you think about it. Like private equity, venture, private real estate, all of those things, like they're all businesses. It's just that for private equity and venture and private real estate, you would expect a slightly higher return because you've got manager risk and you've got liquidity risk. So they need to compensate you for taking those risks. Like if you're going to lock up your capital, or if you're going to transfer the control of your capital to a general partner or a CEO, where you don't have a controlling interest in that company, you're going to demand a higher rate of return. But fundamentally, you can look at the return of the markets and you can make some, you know, draw some conclusions around just general averages around how things are going to perform. So I think this chart, if you know, what it's looking at is the growth of $100 from 1929 until 2020. So if you put $100 in the market in 1929 up till 2020, you're looking at, you know, $100,000+. So the reason I include this is just to anchor it in the sense that if you're invested, chances are over a long period of time, you're going to generate a positive average rate of return. So some of these decisions around who's going to be president, is it going to be Trump, is it going to be Biden, how are things going to perform over the next 3 to 6, 12 months? If your time frame is really short term, there's a lot of risk for probably not that much return in the markets. But if your time frame is 10, 15, 20 plus years, then you can feel fairly confident that every day that you wake up, there's a small positive expected return for you being invested in either public markets, in real estate, private markets. And you can feel good knowing that over time, you're going to get a positive rate of return on average, at least since 1929. Now, the question could be, is it different now, right? This isn't the usual recession. You know, the economy was hit with an exogenous shock from the pandemic, which shut everything down. It wasn't a result of the economics. It wasn't a result of business, you know, causing this particular issue. It was the pandemic. So there's been a lot of, and the economists will probably study this for a number of years, but there's been a lot of talk about what type of recovery we're going to see. Is it going to be like a V-shaped recovery? Right. Is it going to be, you know, something that's a little bit more drawn out? Are we going to go into a really deep recession if, you know, things like borrowing, you know, corporate borrowing or things like that start to really accelerate and we see defaults, so the government gets overextended and has to keep the economy on permanent stimulus to keep things going. And that's where I think none of us really know what the answer is going to be. All we really know is that the markets are pricing, it seems like they're pricing in a very favorable outcome. And I'm guessing that the things that are being priced in right now are the fact that A, interest rates will remain low. Usually when interest rates are low, asset prices are high because people are overbuying essentially equities and other investments to try and achieve higher returns than they can get in the bond market or in other more fixed investments. Because you got to think what's happening here. When people make investment decisions, it's relative, right? I can invest in real estate or I can invest in the stock market. I can invest in cash and bonds or I can invest in currencies. So all of investments is relative. So if interest rates are incredibly low, then relatively speaking, assets like the stock market or real estate might get bid up in price to try and achieve a higher return outcome. So it pushes prices up. So that's supply and demand. So part of what I think is floating asset prices higher is the demand for higher returns than are currently offered in a low interest rate environment. And there's more risk there, right? Because if you want to generate a 7, 8, 9, 10, 12% rate of return 5 years ago, you probably would have to take less risk on a per unit basis to generate that return. Now, if you want to generate a 10, 12+% rate of return, if it's even available, in the markets, you're going to have to take on a disproportionate amount of risk, just given what other instruments are willing to pay you. So I think that's kind of how I would be thinking about it if I was an entrepreneur and my business was doing well, I had cash on the sidelines. It's finding assets that aren't overpriced and just being realistic about the rates of return that you can expect for your money. Anyone who's coming out right now and saying I can get you like a 20% internal rate of return with very little risk, like you got to be very skeptical of those claims. And we've seen a lot of, you know, scandals and just, it, you know, Ponzi schemes and things over the past 12 to 18 months that have come to light, the pandemic kind of spurring that on. But I do think that asset prices are at a high and, you know, you're not being compensated for risk as well as you probably would want to be for putting your capital up in the markets right now.
And then the stock market, the same as making an investment like in a private company where, you know, at the end of the year, you have excess cash and you don't want to get taxed on it.
Yep.
And then if I throw that into the market, am I protected? Is that an expense like it would be if I acquired a company?
Yeah, so it's not, because technically you're not in control of the company, right? With the markets, you're just buying a share of stock. You're just an owner in the company, but you're a minority shareholder and you don't have a controlling interest. So you can't take a deduction unless it's in some form of a retirement plan. Could be a pension plan, could be a 401k, could be some form of profit sharing plan. There's a couple different structures that you could consider if you wanted to.
Our vehicle. So like, let's just do a scenario.
Yeah.
Not happened to me this year because baby bath thought I took a bath, but in general, you might have $100K, $200K at the end of the year in a company, you know, because I have companies that own companies, blah, blah, blah. And then I've been lazy, so I just pay my taxes. But everybody's like, what are you doing? You know, you should be throwing that into, you know, because I'm lazy and I just pay it and I'm a liberal, as you know, so I'm very liberal. So I'm like, I want to build roads, but then maybe that's dumb. But let's say I didn't want to build roads and didn't, you know, let's say I didn't feel good paying all my taxes. Let's say I wanted to save money on taxes. How's that guy? So what are vehicles? So you say I can still invest in the market. I just have to use a vehicle like a 401k or an IRA or something like that. And I can get the same kind of benefit as if I started a new company with the profit and used it as an expense. Is it pretty similar?
Yeah, it's similar. Obviously, there's a lot of factors that could drive that decision. That, you know, where you're at as an entrepreneur as far as how much risk you want to take, what types of returns you're expecting from that investment. If you really do have a good business idea, or you can accelerate the timing of purchases of different equipment or inventory or something like that, that might be a better decision for that capital so that you can get the write-off and you can reduce your taxes. So you'd want to evaluate that on a case-by-case basis, but you can do it either way, right? And a lot of it just comes down to personal preference. Some people really hate paying taxes, and I get that. You know, part of what we do is, you know, start with taxes in mind, looking at a company's P&L, their balance sheet, the type of business they're in, it's a stage of the business they're in, and figuring out, are there ways that we can, you know, shift income around so that we can reduce taxes? Are there structures that we could put in place to eliminate taxes at the sale of the business? Should we be making preparations prior to the sale of the business so that we can structure it so that we can eliminate taxes? I think that, you know, taxes are definitely one component of generating returns. And I find that most people are very, very focused on that one component, and they neglect the other components, which is, how do I actually get the highest after-tax rate of return, right? The return side of it is also very important, because there's a lot of different tax strategies that could be positioned to reduce your taxes or give you flexibility on your, you know, your cash while you're investing it. But I find that a lot of those strategies tend to be illiquid. They tend to be high cost. They tend to be high complexity. And they also tend to produce poor rates of return for those reasons. So I think it's looking at where are you trying to go first, instead of just looking at it like, okay, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, let me reduce my taxes, reduce my taxes, reduce my taxes. You know, what thing can I use to reduce my taxes? It's like, okay, where are you trying to go? And if tax mitigation is a concern or something you want to consider, like, absolutely, there's a ways to do that.
Keep reducing your taxes, but you end up with shitty assets that don't return as much.
Yeah, I mean, you end up with, if you let the tax strategy drive the complete picture as far as investments and planning for the future financially, you end up usually with a lot of different things that don't really work that well together to produce the outcome that you're looking for, which is higher rates of return, lower costs, more liquidity. So that's kind of what I've seen. I feel like the tax pain point is a little oversold. You can absolutely do things. You can get as aggressive as you want. But at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters is what is the actual cash that you have to be able to spend. And most of that's going to be driven by how intelligent you are as far as making investment decisions, not tax decisions. But if you're in real estate, you're in other businesses like that, the tax alpha, so to speak, can get pretty large. So it really depends on the type of business you're in, the cycle of the business. Those types of things are very important.
So this whole thing, you're saying net, that the financial markets aren't that insecure now, but the market actually isn't the market part of this whole thing. No matter who gets reelected over the long term, you're not seeing this craziness to use different strategies because of the time. So like right now, because of the unique times, is there anything you would do differently?
Yeah.
Or are you saying that, no, everything's kind of the same and don't let this be a red herring? Like, is this a red herring and everybody's like, I'm gonna do crazy shit? Or is it pretty much the same shit and ignore all this?
So I think there's a couple things that I would do differently. I think that the marketplace, just with the general uncertainty and kind of, especially in certain industries like service-based businesses, anything that hasn't really been like propelled by the pandemic, I think there's going to be a lot of consolidation in those industries. So we're going to see a lot of mergers and acquisitions are going to accelerate. So if you're looking to sell your business, now could be a good time to potentially sell your business. I think that depending on how well your business is doing, right? I think that the Biden tax plan, if he's reelected, could hurt businesses going forward, just based on the proposal. So I've seen a growing interest in people getting deals done before the end of the year in order to not have to worry about what that could potentially look like under kind of a Democratic leadership. So I think that's a consideration from an asset sale standpoint. As far as like ongoing strategies to consider or way things could potentially be different, it's a little bit too early to tell, but my guess is we have infused the economy with a significant amount of money. I think the national debt is now up to 22 trillion or 23 trillion or something like that. And part of the challenge with that is right now, the interest on servicing that debt is low because the federal funds rate, the interest rates are really low. But eventually, when interest rates start to go back up, the cost of servicing that debt gets higher and higher. And the only way that the government can raise money is through taxes. So I would expect that tax rates would go up over time. So what that means is if you can sell your business now and, you know, mitigate the taxes from the sale, there's tons of strategies that you could use in order to do that. It now could be a good time. But also just being intelligent about how you're setting your businesses up and the vehicles that you're using to reduce taxes in the future could be more relevant. So 401ks, pension plans. I know that's kind of a negative term in the entrepreneur community, setting up retirement plans. Like, I don't need a retirement plan. I don't want to lock my money up. But you can reduce taxes to a fair degree by shifting money from this year to, 20 to 30 years from now. When your income is probably going to be lower and tax rates will hopefully be lower, but who knows? So part of it's a little bit of a bet. Like, we don't know exactly how the tax code's going to change. We don't know, to what degree it's going to change. So I would say that, you want to take into consideration more factors than just that, but trying to think of other things that could potentially change. I think the big one, I'm going to show a chart here real quick. This is kind of a nerdy chart. I'll do my best. What we're looking at here is return per unit of risk. So we've got return on the y-axis, risk on the x-axis. And these are basically different types of investments, different classes of investments. You've got treasuries, which are low risk. You've got private equity, which would be higher risk, higher return. So as the unit of risk increases, the return should also increase at a commensurate level so that somebody feels comfortable with that trade-off, moving from a high-grade bond to a stock to an aggressive stock, et cetera. VC, angel would also be on this scale here. The challenge is that, this is really where I think it's going to change, is if the risk-free rate stays really low, then what it does is it adjusts the return down for all of these assets. So the risk-free rate goes down. It means that on a per unit of risk basis, the return that you would expect from any investment is going to go down based on what I explained earlier, as far as interest rates going down, asset prices go up. When prices go up, expected returns go down. It's kind of the formula for calculating the return on any type of an investment. So the biggest thing that I think is going to come out of this is we're going to see a low interest rate environment for probably a little while. With the potential that we could see accelerated inflation in the future, but I'm not seeing any signs of that right now, given where, the economy is at. What about people,
like, since interest rates are low, like trying to borrow as much money as you can right now at low interest and put them into more high yield?
So that gets into the question, I think, that was asked around, what do we think about corporate debt? With companies just, I think there's like $1 trillion of new corporate debt that was issued so far this year. It's probably more than that at this point. And it's hard to know the direction that that's going to go. And I think it needs to be evaluated at least at the industry level, probably more so at the company level, because when people borrow, they borrow to expand operations, right? They borrow to improve their capital structure because it's cheaper in this environment to take out debt than it is to give away equity if your business is doing well. So you'd want to lever up as much as possible. So debt isn't bad. At the corporate level, it's just a question of, are we over leveraged and who's taking out the debt? So if companies are taking out debt to meet demands on free cash flow because their free cash flow has fallen, that's bad. And if we take this a step forward and say, well, the economy is going to be 18, 24, 36 months until things get back to normal. And some of these companies that have borrowed to meet their free cash flow needs don't come back as quickly as anticipated, we could start to see defaults. Now, if we start to see defaults, what will happen is the banks will start to tighten up lending. And if they start to tighten up lending, then we could see a cascade in securities prices, and we could see more defaults triggered from that activity. So I think you need to be careful if you're an investor and you're saying, hey, I'm going to increase my return by investing in below investment grade debt or high yield debt, because it's offering 4, 5, 6%. The reason it's offering 4, 5, or 6% is probably because there's a lot of risk there, right?
What does that mean? When you say investing in high yield debt, what do you mean by that?
So high yield debt is, there's a lot of credit rating agencies that look at companies and assess their, essentially their ability and, you know, capacity to be able to repay that debt. So they're evaluating them for their chances of default. So high yield debt is debt issued by companies that have a lower probability of being able to make their payments on that debt. So I think right now, the reason why those investments might be attractive from a return standpoint is because they're paying, you know, higher rates of return. But I think that's because the fact that there's some risk on those balance sheets.
You are not an investor, but as a company owner. So should we be going for getting as much cash as we can at low interest rates and investing back in our own companies, or investing that company in 401ks? You'd think that there'd be some arbitrage going on there.
I mean, the 401k is pretty capped as far as how much you can contribute. I'd say it's more like you could set up like a pension plan where you can contribute more, or you could, you know, set up other kind of structures that are a little bit more advanced, like a captive or something like that, depending on the types of risks that you needed to hedge out. So there's options as far as where you could put that money outside of just levering up and investing it in the business. I think the biggest thing to consider is what cycle, you know, how is your business doing? You know, are you taking out debt to improve your capital structure and just to maybe buy back, you know, most of the people in here aren't publicly traded. So it would be more for expanding operations.
Right. Like a healthy commerce company, which are doing very well now. And you go, okay, I could take $1 million, you know, at like 1% or whatever it is, and throw it into Facebook ads. And you know that you're going to, you know, get a 10% versus 20, 30% return on those. Wouldn't it be a good time to be borrowing money to expand?
It absolutely could be. I think it is a question of how much risk are you willing to take, as far as how confident are you that that dollar you put into Facebook is going to turn into 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, and, you know, but you can always repay the debt if it doesn't work out. So right. I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing a lot of leverage right now, is there are companies that are doing well that are just trying to improve their capital structure. They're trying to expand operations. They're taking advantage of the low interest rate environment so that they can just have more money on hand in the event that the economy was to move in a different direction than it is currently, or the markets rather, and liquidity was going to seize. So I think it's hard to know which one of those we're looking at unless you analyze the company very specifically and say, okay, this company needs to do this, this company needs to do that, or they're currently doing that. So I would say it's not a bad decision. You just want to do it in context of the business cycle, where you're at and how you feel it's best to deploy capital.
Interesting. Yeah, very good. We took a little capital and just flipped a company, so it's not bad. So
yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to see like how some industries have been completely like kneecapped from this whole thing, and then others have done incredibly well. Like e-commerce right now, I'm sure, is crushing. Consumer goods, I'm sure, are, you know, doing really well too. And then you've got you know, aerospace, defense, you know, like retail. Food, restaurant, all that stuff is just getting completely just destroyed right now. So I think it's just like a reallocation of
right. The retail, you consolidate.
Yep.
A lot of cheap retail out there because they can't hang on. I'm gonna maybe off the mark, but I've always been interested. So we always read about the wealth gap, and then COVID accelerated that.
Yeah.
Crazily, right? Besides it just being fucked up for humanity, like that's an opinion. But besides that's just fucked up. I mean, in general, because it's just not healthy. I don't think anybody could argue that's not a good thing. But when does that, it seems like the markets don't give a fuck. I mean, so when does, you know, and then it doesn't really affect the people on the opposite side of the wealth gap. So kind of that, it's easy to be insensitive because like, well, there's this wealth gap and they're all suffering. But if you don't have a soul, you're like, well, fuck, it doesn't seem to be affecting me. Mm-hmm. When does that bite people in the ass, not just morally, but, you know, is there a point where that becomes something that is real to greedy people?
Honestly, I think where we're at in the country is a result of that. I think that companies being able to operate with this much leverage and being able to concentrate wealth and create wealth so quickly and give it to such a disproportionate few of us has gotten us to the point where most of the population is angry and they don't know what they're angry at. So they're manufacturing all these reasons to be angry. Well, I think what they're really angry at is that they don't have a place in the new economy, and they're frustrated by it. And the reaction to it is, well, let's, you know, the political environment, it's everything that's going on right now. So I think that, you know, if we continue to allow companies to operate in this way, to create these monopolies and which they are. I mean, Google and Facebook, like they're anti-competitive.
Like, they're stealing $20 million by cutting, like firing workers and paying them less. Like, that's a big part of the wealth gaps. And which I get, you know, I think doesn't matter. Opinion is, I think it's fucked up. But regardless, when does that fuck up the people on the other side? And most people, maybe bathwater, have made it. I mean, we're kind of on the nice side of the wealth gap, right? And we can talk morally, and that's one thing. But actually, when does that just stop? I mean, when does that get so gappy that nobody will work?
I mean, I think people will work. I think the issue is that too many people are going to be seeking work, and there's not going to be enough jobs available because the economy will have out-evolved the population, and they'll be hard to reskill. So they'll just continue to get angrier and angrier. And if the capitalist system is left unchecked, it's going to continue to concentrate wealth because that's what it does. So I'm capitalist. I think it's a great system, but there probably needs to be some type of controls in place. They would at this point need to be legislated, it sounds like, and there's going to be a lot of resistance to that, which there currently is, because you know, you can just see it in all of the divisiveness in the country.
They trick people for so long. So the angrier they are, the more draconian measures will happen once they control the legislators, which they will, because you can only trick with media. You see what's happening. Like, they can only be tricked by the media,
how I don't think this is going to be an overly attractive country to be an entrepreneur in within the next 10 years. Like, I think eventually this will be it'll be hard and not really worth the risk, frankly, to be an entrepreneur in this country if things were to continue to go the direction that they're going to go, because
we want to have all the money, because we all laugh until it becomes us.
Yeah. And it's getting close. I mean, we're in very interesting times.
Until Bezos and Buffett own everything. Right. So when we're on the other side, it'll be really, really, I think opinions will change. So what country would you go to? Or is there a way what do you do knowing this is probably going to happen? I'm seeing it. Like, what would you do knowing this is going to happen, to go to a safer place or change it within?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's obviously going to be dependent on the person's situation. Like, can they relocate? Where are they at? Are they going to sell? If you sell your business, you got a lot more flexibility as far as like where you want to go and where you want to live and different tax havens and stuff like that, where you can, you know, maintain dual citizenship or relinquish your citizenship. So I think, you know, if I was an entrepreneur, my goal would be to be liquid within 10 years and preferably sooner. And I don't have any data to back that up. That's just kind of the general feeling that I have, kind of seeing the way the economy is evolving and just like the speed in which wealth is being concentrated and the speed that I'm seeing in M&A. You know, like every single industry that I've looked at, for the most part, if it's not a new industry, is starting to consolidate. It's going to get way more competitive, I think, in a lot of industries over the next 5 to 10 years. So I would be looking for liquidity, and I would be looking for flexibility on whatever your belief system is. You live there, and everyone's going to be different as far as that's concerned. But I think a lot more people are going to be looking for, you know, and this is a weird idea that I have. It's kind of similar to baby bathwater, but you know, I think people are going to be looking for to be significant in some way. So I could see like the sprouting up of like smaller communities where like somebody's, you know, given a position and they like trade in their 401k and now they're like the town bartender and that's like their thing. Right. And like there's small communities of people and it gets back to more of like a, you know, a society where people can actually like cooperate and create things. But we'll see, who knows, the world could also burn down in flames. So.
Yeah. Like, let's go one scenario. So I'm curious about it. So like you have in Europe, it's a little more socialist leaning. And then because of the wealth gap, I think that people will wise up and go, hey, this shit ain't fair. And then, but then sometimes you get overcompensation. So you might have some draconian measures, what we consider as, this entrepreneurial country as draconian, making it harder and harder, right, to maybe do things, right? Because that's what you're talking about, I think. You're saying that, you know, that's what people are going to go, wow, so then there's going to be way higher taxes, way more restrictions, and you have to pay employees this much and way more rules, which makes it harder and harder to be an entrepreneur.
It's just not worth it. I mean, we can shut down the economy. We can ruin your business overnight. We can raise taxes to 60 to 70%. We've got these monopolies that are left unchecked doing anti-competitive behavior, so you can't compete in those verticals anymore. And if you do, they can overnight switch into your industry and completely wipe you off the face of the earth. So the risk return trade-off, it's similar to the chart that I just showed. It's like for every unit of risk, the return should be higher. But if we start to implement these types of measures, it reduces what the payoff could look like. So the amount of risk that you need to take in order to generate the level of wealth that you want just isn't worth it anymore. So
yeah, just with evolution, whenever there's a gap, somebody else comes in its place. So if this happens to the US, there'll be countries that go, yeah, now we're the new country for entrepreneurs, I would assume, because usually there's always nature abhors a vacuum. So it would probably be another country that'd be like, yeah, come over here.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be opportunity, right? So I don't want to say like there's no opportunity. There's always going to be opportunity for people in this group to do whatever it is that they want to do. So I just think that in certain fields, certain industries, it's going to be harder and harder to compete. So it's just about being nimble and continuing to look for opportunities, whether that's in the US or outside the US, and expanding your skill set. So, but yeah, I think everything will be fine. It's just interesting to see how the country's evolving.
So where are you putting your money? And then are you expanding or contracting?
So my money is invested primarily in public markets. The reason why is I don't have the time, even though I handle our investment policy. I don't think it's worth it to do due diligence on private companies where I don't have a controlling interest and give away my money to a company that can basically lose all my money without any recourse, right? And if I want my money back, they can apply discounts for lack of marketability, discounts for lack of control. You know, they can file bankruptcy. Like, there's just a ton of different things that can happen where I would just lose my money. I'm just not comfortable with that risk unless I was a general partner in the fund and I was sourcing deals, which I am, because we do M&A inside of our wealth management firm. So I have exposure to private markets. It's just through my business that I have that exposure. So my personal wealth is all in either publicly traded real estate, public stock, 12,000 companies around the world, and a little bit in fixed income. But otherwise, all of my wealth is concentrated in the business right now.
Then are you trying to expand now or contract based on the future?
Expand from an investment standpoint or just expand the business?
So your business, but now then as an entrepreneur, because you have your company. So are you going, hey, let's just be cool? Or are you like, that's a great time for growth?
Great time for growth, I think, depending on your industry. So my industry is consolidating. We're actually being acquired by a larger firm. I'm going to be the president of that company once we merge all of our assets in. So collectively, I think we'll be at like a $1.5 billion wealth management tax accounting firm. And we're aggressively acquiring and merging in other firms. So I'm participating in the consolidation of a developed industry. So I'm expanding.
Actually, more questions about that, because I think we've pretty much covered the overall stuff.
Yeah. We don't need to,
So when you get acquired, I think a lot of people, we have a lot of people following Mac, people are getting acquired, and I mean, a lot of baby bathwater friends might have sold, things like that. And then when I'm over a beer, they're like, you know, never go with it, right? Because you lose control. Like, they're like, don't fuck that, get the fuck out and do something else, right? Because we're doers, whatever, you know, like that whole attitude we have. So you've decided to be acquired, but stay. Walk me through that, and what are your risks? What was your thought process? What are your risks by not just taking the money and running?
That's a really good question. So I view our industry, my industry, which is financial services, as an industry that will consolidate aggressively over the next 10 years. So I think there's a lot of opportunity if you're well positioned and you have an audience and you have the right value proposition to be able to do that. But from my perspective, our company wasn't big enough and we didn't have enough capital to do it alone. So the pandemic pushed that out of reach for us, because better capitalized companies could then go up and pick up assets on the cheap from, you know, other firms that didn't have the sustainability, right? So partly driven by market forces, and then partly driven by my decision to want to specialize a little bit. So I run two companies. One's a consulting practice management firm in the financial services industry. The other is the wealth management tax and accounting firm. And you know, I feel like my skill set is more aligned with doing the deals and like sourcing deals and building thought, you know, thought leadership or whatever you want to call it, credibility in my industry. So the merger for me strategically gave me that opportunity. And then as far as why not just take the cash and run versus, you know, do partly cash, partly share exchange, which is the proposed structure of the deal. I think it's really gets down to what role you want to play. You know, if you're a true kind of entrepreneur and you're like, listen, if I'm not driving, I'm going to freak out and yeah, I know I'm going to pull this car off the road. Then you need to leave, right? You don't want to stick around because it's going to be miserable. I think from my standpoint, I know where my industry's at and there really aren't any other opportunities in my industry to where I'd feel confident I could create the same type of wealth. And my ego is now to a point where I feel like I can collaborate. I think 5 years ago, I would have been that guy, or even 2 years ago, I would have been that guy, like, I got to drive, I got to make all the decisions. And I still drive it. I'm still driving it forward as like the president of the company, but like, you know.
Did you mitigate your risk of not being in control of them doing some nefarious things to push you out? Like, what did you do? Yep. That's more valuable to everybody when you sell and you're going to go with it.
Yeah.
What did you do? I know you're smart. I mean, I know you think about things. So what did you do that other people could learn from to protect yourself from this happening? And then all of a sudden you getting kind of fucked.
Yeah. So there's always ways that people can fuck you. So that's kind of, let's start with that as the premise. You know, one of the main ways is they just stop paying your salary and they try and freeze you out. And they've got, you know, in this case, the company I'm merging with has two attorneys on staff. They could literally just bleed me out if they wanted to. So there's no perfect way to protect yourself in this scenario. Now I know that they want to create wealth and I'm confident that the solution that we've built and the team that we've built would be very hard for them to walk away from. So there is some measure of that they would be dumb as shit to do that, but there are always risks in combinations. So the measures that I took and are still frankly, you know, being negotiated. And, you know, one of these was from a conversation with Mac Lackey, cause I'm in his exit DNA program. So him and I kind of talk, you know, once a month, once every 45 days, was to put like a put in place where instead of them buying out my entire interest up front, I basically have a floor or, you know, I have a put to where in 5 to 6 years, if they don't want to exit, they have to buy me out at a specific multiple. So that gives me the ability to get liquidity, but just not all up front. The other thing is, you know, when you're negotiating your employment contracts, you definitely want to have a board seat. You know, that helps, but it's not depending on the structure of the board. If it's three of them and one of you, you're kind of screwed anyway. So we structured it with 7 board members, a few of which are independent. So hopefully that adds a little bit of a layer of protection there. And then just making your employment agreement as, you know, as bulletproof as it possibly can be with, you know, mandatory, you know, severance if they fire you, immediate vesting of any stock options, anything like that, you know, no ability to repurchase your shares or anything like that. Like you own your shares at the time of merger, writing in things to the operating agreement where they're not able to shift assets or start entities or anything like that outside of the parent company. So you're definitely going to want to engage with a really good corporate attorney.
Be good to have a checklist. That's pretty cool. I've looked at that heavily now. Very cool. That'd be a cool checklist to share.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have one. I think that's more for like, you know, probably Matt Moisen or a corporate attorney who does these, you know, agreements.
These are generalities. I understand them. So just like overwhelming. Of course you have a lawyer do it, but you can go like, there's your checklist of shit that they can, you know, like, the checklist of ways you can get fucked.
Yeah, when I was talking to my attorney, I was basically like, she was telling me all the risks and she's protected me in other deals before because I've had other partnerships that have blown up and we've been doing M&A for a while. So you just take your lumps. But I was like, just, you know, I have the possibility of getting fucked. Just tell me all the risks. Like, where are the risk points that I can get screwed over? And like, let's do our best to make it expensive for them to screw me over. That's about the best you can do.
We were looking at making like I think a lot of people maybe Bathlet or don't have good operating agreements. Halls and I actually have a good one, but we were just structuring one and they were like, wow. And then the lawyer language is like, they cloak it really what we found, these lawyers cloak really common sense things in really hard to understand language. But once you understand it in English, you're like, oh yeah, that makes fucking sense. So we were thinking about making like the how not to get fucked with an acquisition for 10-year-olds. Like the list, right? Of course you go to the lawyer and write it up in the whatever language the fuck they want. But like the 2-page checklist, or when we talk about operating agreements, like could somebody just write an operating agreement that a 10-year-old could understand? Because it's actually all understandable by a 10-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And the attorneys and whoever's doing the deal usually like introduces the complexity. The biggest thing is like, you know, stock options and profit interest units and like different things that are not actual equity in the company. Like that's a good way to get screwed too. So like I was big on.
That's not hard to understand if they're explained to you in a simple way.
Yeah, so, agreed. Yeah.
Paul and I are very dedicated now. We want to publish like the 2-page operating agreement, you know, make a choice. It's all like understandable by a very simple person. And it'd be fun to have like little checklists, even on like what you're talking about, like the chart you showed us for investments. Like, let's just make these.
Yeah. Investing for dummies, essentially. Like, don't make dumbass mistakes.
Really simple.
The other thing is like the M&A structure that I have, I think it's like, we've spent a lot of money and time refining it over the years. Like, I think it could be very applicable to marketing. So I don't know who's listening to this call, but like the biggest reason why you do a merger or, you know, an acquisition is the lift from the transaction. So like, as an example, if you acquire a text marketing company and you're an email marketing company, like you have a subscriber base that you just acquired that you can upsell your service, you get an immediate lift to revenue. So there's like strategic reasons why both of those parties would consider integrating. So we've created a structure that I think would work incredibly well in some of these newer industries that haven't reached that point of consolidation yet, right? Because my industry is like late in the game. The newer industries, M&A really hasn't accelerated yet. So I think there could be an opportunity, whether that's in e-commerce or marketing, you know, just general marketing. I see an opportunity there. So
see that. We're going to start sharing stuff like that. And that's going to be our rule.
It's
going
cool.
to be the baby of these things, you know, the baby of the thinking is great. Actually, like once the lawyer explains to you and you read all that hieroglyphics, but then you actually see it, you're like, oh wow, like fucking well thought out. But you're like, the bathwater is like, why can't you just fucking write it? Like say it, man. So it's, I want to go a bunch of things like this and get the baby out of all these years of experience. Cause they're all real. I mean, it's not like the lawyers are making up stuff that isn't smart.
Yeah.
It's just the way it's presented as the bathwater.
Yeah. It's brutal. It's brutal. And I think I've read through like hundreds of these freaking things at this point. So it's painful.
Well, this is cool. Any other, this is neat. Any other advice? Cause it is uncertain times, but it sounds like you're saying it's uncertain time, but in the general, like don't, you know, red herring is it's like a lot of people because of it, they're going to fall for a bunch of shit because this uncertain times. And you're saying, well, if you really look at it right now, there are some, what I'm hearing, the nutshell is some things are a little different. And you got to watch out. But overall, the fundamentals haven't changed much, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamentals of like wealth creation haven't changed. I think it's just, you know, the behavior around what's going on can be influenced. So I think as an entrepreneur, the biggest thing that I would see coming out of this is people are doing well in certain industries. They've got excess cash. They expect higher rates of return than are available in the market. They make bad decisions, they wipe out their cash. You see it in every single market cycle. Instead of just recognizing that, you know, asset prices are what they are, you know, for a variety of reasons, and being more measured in your expectations around what you can actually get from the markets. And then taking a more, you know, holistic approach, instead of focusing on how do I reduce my taxes only in 1 year? It's like, well, how do I grow my wealth more through a combination of investments, taxes, smart planning strategies, and freeing your time up to do things in, you know, other industries or with your business where you have a controlling interest, instead of trying to like micromanage things where you don't have a controlling interest and aren't really going to produce wealth.
Unless you have some real insider knowledge and some vertical you understand really well and you have power.
Yep.
Kind of stick to the macro thing, but you know, but there are like short-term because of the chaos ways you could probably win, but only if you really have power within it and just know shit other people don't. But if you don't.
Exactly. Yeah. If you have information in your industry where you feel like if you acted on that information with leverage and capital, you can make more money, do it if it's in line with your risk tolerance. But if somebody says, hey, I have information that I think you can profit on. Give me your money. It's like, well, why the hell aren't you mortgaged to the hilt, you know, and doing this yourself? And it's like, okay, well, can I trust that? What's the motives behind it? So just being, you know, taking that extra second to think through.
Back when rich people ask me for money to invest in their project, and I'm like, wait a second, like, why aren't you investing in your project?
Yeah, and not all these things are bad. So there are some private deals and, you know, opportunities that should be considered and funded, and, you know, they can provide really good outcomes for people. It's just a matter of, like, you know, just vetting it more than, you know, hey, it's my friend and he asked me for money. It's usually not.
Well, very cool, man. I appreciate this, and it's cool. I want to watch the acquisition. And then, yeah, as we can, our whole goal during next year is to simplify all these things. There won't be legal documents, but super, like, these checklists of the lawyers have created and all that we can actually, like, have as Baby Bath Letter documents to go through. Obviously not your contract, but, like, to discuss. And that way I think save a lot of money on lawyers to go in like, hey, here's my answer to these fucking 20 questions. Right. And you have weird language, but you know,
love it.
You know,
yeah. I mean, I think that can be applied, like you said, to pretty much any type of business part of the business. So I think that'll be very useful. If I can help in any way, just let me know.
I'm going to hit you up.
So, cool, man. Awesome, brother.
Hi, man. And yeah, can't wait to hang out.
Me too, man. Well, hopefully I'll see you soon. Thank you guys so much for inviting me on. It was fun.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.